Thank you. Can everybody hear me? Is that clear enough? Acoustics are not the best thing here. Tonight I want to talk not so much about particular issues and events, but about the concepts we use to define things, the ideas that we use to give meaning to these issues and events. The two concepts I want to investigate are culture and class power. Is that okay? That was the title, so that's what we're going to... It sounds kind of academic, and it sort of is in a way, but we do have to pay attention to these things at times. Now, culture is usually defined as the mores, customs, accumulated solutions, and practices of a society, including the language, art, laws, religion, and all that. And such a definition, that's the one I learned in anthropology and in sociology, such a definition has a nice neutral sound to it. But culture is anything but neutral. Much of what we call our common culture is really a class-dominated culture, strongly favoring some interests over others. A society built, for instance, on slave labor swiftly develops a racist culture with its own peculiar laws, science, and mythology, along with mechanisms of repression directed against slaves and other opponents of slavery. So culture is not an abstract force that just floats around in space and settles on us like a ubiquitous disembodied entity, although sometimes it might feel that way because we pick up so much of it subliminally. But culture, in fact, is mediated through a social structure. In other words, we get our culture from a network of social relations involving other people, family, peers, other primary groups, and increasingly from more formally articulated secondary institutions like schools, media, government, corporations, the military, and the like. These social institutions, in turn, are also misrepresented as being politically neutral. In fact, they're endowed with strong ideological agendas, which are made no less weak because they're often implicit and often unstated. When culture is treated as nothing more than an innocent accretion of practices and customs, then all cultures are accepted at face value, and cultural relativism becomes the suggested standard. We're told that we should respect other cultures. Now, to be sure, after centuries of seeing indigenous cultures being trampled underfoot by colonizers, we need to be acutely aware of the baneful effects that cultural imperialism has on ethnic cultures abroad and within our own society. But it's one thing to support multiculturalism, and it's something else to say that we can't judge any culture no matter what's done in its name. I once heard an official on TV from Saudi Arabia saying that you Westerners should stop condemning our culture or interfering or judging our culture, and you should respect our culture. He was, Saudi Arabia this is, right? He was defending, or he was addressing critics who had denounced the Saudi practice of stoning women to death on suspicion of adultery. So we're supposed to say, oh, well, that's your culture, right? He failed to mention that there are people within his own culture, including, of course, the female victims, who are opposed to such time-honored traditions. For most of U.S. history, slaveholders, and then the last century, segregationists, all insisted that we respect the South's way of life, their culture, respect Southern traditions. In Nazi Germany, anti-Semitism was an integral part of the ongoing political culture. So you see, many evils can gather under the banner of cultural relativism. The truth is, we must challenge the oppressive and destructive features of all cultures, including our own. And that's not just my opinion. That's part of international law. The cultural relativist position and the postmodernist relativist position, you know, there are no absolutes, so who's to say, blah, blah, all that stuff, which is tailor-made for academics who don't want to take a stand. These relativist positions are refuted by the existence of that wonderful UN document called the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. This was signed by nations of widely diverse value systems and cultures, all of them recognizing, at least on paper, recognizing that basic human rights exist and transcend particular cultures. And no culture, no matter how old, no matter how venerable, no matter how steeped in this or that tradition, no culture has the right to violate these basic rights. We're also taught to think of culture as deeply entrenched and not easily modified. In fact, I would suggest that as class interests change, so does much of the culture. Well, not all of it, of course. For instance, for 400 years, the wealthy elites of Central America were devoutly Roman Catholic, a religious affiliation that supposedly was deeply ingrained in their culture. Then, in the late 1970s, after many Catholic clergy proved friendly to liberation theology and began making common cause with the poor, these same upper-class Central American elites discarded their Catholicism and in very substantial numbers began to join Protestant fundamentalist denominations that espoused a more comfortably reactionary line. So, four centuries of deeply ingrained Catholic culture was discarded within a few years once they decided their class interests were at stake. What do you think of that, Father Bill? Is he here? Let me see. Are you just going to sit there and let this happen? Culturalistic explanations of third world social conditions tend to be patronizing and ethnocentric. Whenever someone starts explaining something about society by telling about their culture, I always get on guard. I once heard a commentator remark that the poor performance of the Mexican army in a storm rescue operation in Acapulco, October 97, was emblematic of a cultural, a thing in the Mexican culture. He said it passing. It was a talk show thing. So, well, it's the Mexican lackadaisical way of handling things, chuckle, chuckle. You know, it's their culture. Everything is mañana, mañana with those people. In fact, my friends, in fact, the Mexican army, financed and advised by the U.S. national security state, performed brilliantly in Chiapas, doing the thing it was trained to do, which is not rescuing people, but intimidating and killing them. The Mexican army waged low-intensity warfare, burned crops, destroyed villages, executed suspected guerrilla sympathizers. To say the Mexican army performed poorly in rescue operations is to presume that the army is there to serve the people rather than to control them on behalf of those who own Mexico. So culturalistic explanations that are divorced from political economic realities often lend themselves to this kind of facile, patronizing approach, usually done in a very all-knowing tone too. Now, as the capitalist economy has grown in influence and power over the last two centuries, much of our culture has been expropriated and commodified. Nowadays, we actually create less of our culture and we buy more of it. We even have a special term now for those segments of culture that remain rooted in popular practice. We call it folk culture. It includes folk music, folk dance, folk medicine, folklore. These really, when you think about it, these are very curious terms, because all culture should be folk culture. I mean, all culture is created by us folks, you would think. But here's a recognition that that isn't true. We're saying that genuine folk culture has become so limited that it's now given a distinctive label. A far greater part of our culture is now designated, quite correctly, I think, as mass culture, pop culture, even media culture, owned and operated mostly by giant corporations for profit and for cultural class hegemony. The goal now is no longer social creativity, but social control. I can remember, you know, just 50 years ago, when I was starting college, we still had something of a working class culture in America. It was discernible. There were union halls and union songs and poetry and literature, theater, night schools, summer camps, mutual assistance societies. Many of these were organized by anarchists. More of them were organized by communists and their front groups. Almost all of that culture just could not survive the twin blows of McCarthyism and television, which both came at about the same time in the 1950s. And this profit-driven culture preempts people's cultures, of course, not only in the U.S., but it's happening all over the world as critics overseas, critics of cultural imperialism, are complaining and reminding us. New cultural practices and values can emerge, and new cultural struggles, but usually within a limited framework that doesn't challenge the dominant class arrangement. We have what's called culture wars now. Culture wars around feminism, ethnicity, gay rights, various lifestyle issues. By the way, these can be very important issues. These can be issues of life and death at times. This kind of identity politics is sometimes given play in the media if it's presented purely as lifestyle issues without explicit class content. So, in other words, racism will be acknowledged or attended to if it's defined as an attitudinal problem. That's what Clinton was doing when he was in office. Remember, he said, we have to give attention to racism, and what did it mean? Having these little town meetings, and how do you feel about this group, and how do you feel about that group, as if that was it. Rarely is any attention given to the institutional or structural or political economic forces behind racism that batten on it. So you can fight racism as long as you don't also then, and I'm talking about in the major mainstream media, as long as you also say, don't start talking about how functional it is in depressing wages, in dividing the working class, in creating a reserve army of labor and doing things like that. If you start saying things like that, you're out. I mean, you're being ideological or irrelevant, and that's not what we want to talk about. The victories that are won by identity politics struggle are usually limited to changes in style and personnel. So they leave these class interests largely intact. For instance, feminists have challenged patriarchal militarism, a very real challenge. What is the accommodating response? Is it the end of militarism? No, our military budgets are higher than ever. It's female generals. Women in the army. Eventually, with feminism, we get female political leaders. But what strike? Lynn Cheney, Elizabeth Dole, Margaret Thatcher. And just as some of us were recovering from Jean Kirkpatrick, we got Madeleine Albright. And just as some of us are trying to recover from Madeleine Albright, we're getting, with this new Bush administration, Christy Whitman, Gail Norton, head of the Interior. She doesn't like the environment, and she's presiding over it. Now, George II, and tonight was not about the Hanover monarchy, George II, he's learned from Clinton, you see, that is, have ethnic and gender diversity, it's good window dressing, it looks egalitarian, democratic, picks up a few votes maybe. It's no accident that this type of female policymaker, this right-wing female policymaker, is more likely to reach the top of the present political economic structure. I mean, even though conservative females have been indifferent to feminism, and sometimes outrightly hostile to feminism, they're not above reaping some of its benefits. Brother, speaking of appointments under George II, I have a story to tell you. Now, this is a true story, because, you know, everything you hear tonight is going to be true. George W. Bush was having dinner with the Queen of England. All right, this isn't literally true. Don't be so literally minded. Be so narrow, literally minded. It's allegorically true. So there was George II and Elizabeth II. And he turns to her and he says, Your Magistrate, she finally realizes he's talking to her, and he says, how do you know how to pick intelligent subordinates, people for your staff? And she says, well, that's very easy. You just ask them a question and you monitor the quality of their response. For instance, she then looks over at Tony Blair, who's also at this table of notables, and she says, Prime Minister, if your mama and your papa had a child, I can't believe I'm telling this story, but I feel like it. It's so cold in here, I gotta warm myself up a bit. She says, Prime Minister, if your mama and your papa had a child, but it wasn't your brother and it wasn't your sister, who would it be? And Tony Blair thinks, and he says, oh, Your Majesty, it would be me. And so she turns to George II and says, do you see? He says, yes, I get it. So the next day, George II is in the Oval Office, and he calls up Jesse Helms, Senator Jesse Helms, little fascist senator from North Carolina. And he says, Senator Helms, if your mommy and your daddy had a little itty-bitty baby, and it wasn't your brother, and it wasn't your sister, who would it be? And Helms says, I'll be danged if I know, but wait a minute, Vice President Dick Cheney's here in my office, I'll ask him. So he asks Cheney, wasn't your brother, wasn't your sister, who would it be? And Cheney thinks about it, and he says, well, it'd be me. Who is it? Me. Oh, so Helms gets very excited, picks up the phone, and says, Mr. President, I got the answer. Now, this baby, it wasn't my brother, and it wasn't my sister. I know who it is. Yeah, who? It's Dick Cheney. And Bush shakes his head and says, no, you dumb jackass, it's Tony Blair. I don't want to encourage those kind of jokes because this guy isn't as dumb as they're making him out to be. But now that joke had two punchlines, so it's got to hold you for a while, okay? I hope by now that you're sensing that culture is linked to class power. And class power is what I want to talk about next. When certain concepts are eliminated from public discourse, then so are certain thoughts. Ideas become very difficult to explore when there are no words to express them, or no acceptable words to express them. When a term like class power is dismissed as ideological, it's easier to dispose of other politically unaccepted concepts, such as class exploitation, class interest, and class struggle. When the great Italian communist leader, Antonio Gramsci, was incarcerated in Mussolini's dungeons, 1928 to 1937, he wrote about politics and culture in his now famous prison notebooks, but he couldn't use certain words. He had to code the words. And when the things were translated, they were uncoded, but he had to use codes for words like Marxism, revolution, class, capitalism, He was not allowed to use those words. Such words would attract the attention of his fascist jailers, who would then prevent him from... Excuse me. I think I'm catching pneumonia here. That would prevent him from doing any more... Is this still on? Can you hear me? Is the mic still on? I've lost the amp. Oh, it's that. Yeah, it's that thing. Oh, it's that thing I'm hitting. I gotta be careful. Okay, next time it happens, I'll know. That's Father Bill Donnelly, who's the priest here at the church. So the fascists understood that their job was to suppress class consciousness wherever it might appear. Now today, most of our intellectuals and our social commentators avoid using the word class almost as carefully as did Gramsci. Unlike him, they're not in prison. They don't need a fascist censor breathing down their necks because they have a mainstream one implanted in their heads. Gramsci knew he was being censored. Many academics and media pundits think they're free as birds. And by the way, they are free as birds as long as they fly around in the right circles, which means not in left circles. Even among supposedly left writers, there are some who are so fervently anti-Marxist as to seize upon anything but class to explain what's happening in the world. Now, I'm not saying class isn't used. There's a lot of sociological studies that deal with class, of course, as you know. And they use class and correlate it with voting pattern behaviors, income level, social stratification, divorce rates, just about anything. But class, in that sense, is used largely as a demographic trait. And by that view, there are many class groupings. And so we hear about blue-collar class, a white-collar class, a middle class, an upper-middle class, a professional class, a managerial class, a professional managerial class, a professional managerial technocratic class. We have inner-city dwellers, suburbanites, dot-comers, and yuppies. And all of this is supposed to give us a more nuanced and subtler understanding than what's to be found in the crude bipolarity that's found in Marxism of capitalists and workers. And so this is more nuanced. By the way, academics love nuance. It's nuanced. And something, you can get things so nuanced that you don't ever look at certain crude realities, you know. But the truth is, you don't have a more nuanced analysis simply because you bring in more variables. An analysis is nuanced depending on how you use the variables. What I'm saying is that many social scientists, many media commentators and pundits have perfected the art of looking at class in capitalist society without ever having to look at capitalism itself. And all through this, there's not a word about the most important class of all, the owning class. The Mellons, Morgans, Murdochs, Rockefellers, DuPonts, Hunts, Belmonts, Fricks, Vanderbilts, Gates, and others. The people who own the lion's share of the capital of the United States and much of the rest of the world. And not much is ever said about their class power. Very little is said about how immense wealth translates into political control and cultural hegemony. Attention is given to every social group except the capitalist class itself, to every conflict except class conflict. I remember a seminar at the Institute of Policy Studies in Washington, a very noted sociologist, and writer and speaker, she's known to many of you, I won't mention names, because you make a criticism, people say, oh, you personally attacked. No, I'm just making a criticism of the position of statement she's made. So I'm not going to say her name. But she was talking about her study on class, and she had on the board, she had managerial, white-collar, blue-collar, professional, poor, inner city, blacks, all this sort of stuff. And I said, you left out that other class, the class that owns all this other stuff. No mention of it. And by the way, most of the stratification studies in sociology do that all the time. They leave out that class that owns the whole thing, that owns the White House, that owns its occupant. He's part of them. Now, I want to offer what I think is a more important way of conceptualizing class. Without denying that there are demographic and status dimensions and lifestyle differences that exist both within and between classes, we might think of a class not as a demographic trait, but as a social relationship. Thus, any one class gets its definition from its linkage to another. Class is a social relationship. There can be no slaveholders unless there are slaves. There can be no feudal lords unless there are serfs. There can be no capitalists without workers. This means that class, by definition, means, contains in it, by definition, if you're talking class, it means social inequality and economic exploitation. In that sense, it differs from race and gender. Because we can perceive of equal relationships someday existing between ethnic groups or between men and women. But we can't conceive that, you can't perceive that as existing between classes by definition. It's the unequal component between classes that defines them in the first place. As Victor Wallace pointed out, a very underrated political scientist, a really smart guy, I wish he would write more. Victor Wallace, years ago, noted, quote, "One cannot talk about equality between the capitalist class and the working class. The capitalist class would not exist if it did not dominate the working class." Now, in my more nuanced definition of class, the crucial axis of the relationship is not between the two classes as such, but their respective relationship to a third factor, what the Marxists call the means of production, the factories, mines, oil wells, agribusinesses, investment houses, banks, real corporations, shipping lines, airlines, hotels, hospitals, newspaper and magazine chains, television networks, etc., 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 and go on and on. Class is a relationship between those who own these productive and financial capital, the means of production, and those who work for the owners. This relationship is a highly dynamic and exploitative one, involving the constant transfer of wealth from worker to owner. It explains how some people can accumulate ever more riches without working, or by doing only a fraction of the work that enriches them, and others can work all their lives and end up with nothing but an insecure retirement. By defining class as a relationship to economic power, we learn something about who gets what. How is the value that's produced but not consumed in production costs, how is this surplus distributed and reinvested? Now, there are only two small select groups in all of North America who believe there's such a thing as surplus value, and that's the Marxists and the capitalists. In fact, the capitalists even have a term for it. They call it added value, or value added. They're always talking about that with each other. They don't talk to you about it, but with each other. The actual technical term is value added in manufacture. In 1955, for instance, General Motors estimated that an average auto worker added value of $150,000 in 1 year of work, while he was paid only $38,000, or about one-fourth of the value added. Now, General Motors doesn't publicize that very widely. As I say, it was in one of their in-house trade publications. The added value, ladies and gentlemen, the added value is what it's all about. Does it go primarily for the private enrichment of an owning class or for collective betterment, human services, and community needs? Around that issue, many important political economic battles have been fought and are still being fought. Look at the phony energy crisis we're having right now. PG&E crying poverty, bankruptcy, rate hiking us into poverty. What happened to the $5 billion in earnings, PG&E, that you had not long ago? Well, we couldn't develop new energy sources with that money because that money went to something more essential. It went to our shareholders. They walked off with billions, and now the company cries poverty and needs to be bailed out by the greatest of all financiers of free market capitalism, the greatest of all benefactors of free market capitalism. That's the taxpayers and the consumers, who are one and the same guys, us. You know, it reminds me, David Roderick summed it up. David Roderick was president of U.S. Steel Corporation years ago. And when he was president, he said, U.S. Steel is not in the business of making steel. It's in the business of making profits. And you know, your heart leaps when a moment of truth, a flicker of truth comes out of these guys, you know. I mean, that's a fantastic, beautiful statement. It's not in the business of making steel, it's in the business of making profits. And that's what PG&E is in effect saying. Pacific Gas and Electric is not in the business of producing and distributing gas and electric. It's in the business of making profits. And then we have a governor in Sacramento who acts just like this president in Washington. He announces a crisis and goes into action and uses it as an opportunity to give bailouts and payoffs to the rich and powerful. So we're exploited not only as workers. The exploitation process doesn't stop there. It goes on, and we're exploited as taxpayers and consumers. The pay you get has already had the surplus value taken out of it. But then other things are taken out. Do you remember your first paycheck? When you think back, way back those days, remember that first paycheck you ever got, and you looked at it and you said, there must be some mistake. I mean, this is supposed to be for 2 weeks. It looks more like 1 week. You say, no, here's the other week. We took off for that. We took off for that. So the exploitation goes on, you see. And through all of this, by the way, the owning class itself, as we said, is kept out of sight, not only by the sociological studies, but even by the U.S. Census Bureau. The U.S. Census Bureau reports that in the last two decades, incomes for the richest fifth of the population increased by 30%, or nearly $27,000 after adjusting for inflation. After adjusting for inflation, the average income of the richest 20% was $117,000. This top quintile, this top 20%. Was $117,000, almost 13 times larger than the $9,200 average income of the poorest 20%. so. It's a 13-to-1 spread, and 20 years ago it was only 9-to-1. And again and again and again and again we keep hearing this about these quintiles, the top 20%, the richest 20%, the poorest 20%. You can see it almost every liberal publication. And I'm sitting there and I'm saying, what are these figures about? What the hell is the U.S. Census Bureau talking about? An average $117,000 is an upper middle class income. It's not rich. By designating the top 20% of the entire population as the richest segment, that means 50 million people in 1995, that's when this report was, that's the richest quintile, the Census Bureau is including millions of people who make as little as $65,000. That's the rich they're talking about. So puzzled by all of this, I had a research assistant call the Census Bureau in 95. It turns out that the Bureau never interviewed anyone who had an income higher than $300,000. Isn't that an interesting revelation? It's one of the best-kept secrets in America. And our investigative team unearthed that. Without the slightest help from Dennis Bernstein. Yeah, yeah, yeah. A Census Bureau official said that their computers couldn't handle higher amounts. Hello? Hello? Your computer couldn't handle higher amounts? Couldn't handle higher amounts? The Bureau has finally, they did say, well, this year we're going to lift our upper limit to $1 million. But this still excludes the very richest, the hundreds of multi-billionaires, the thousands of multi-millionaires, all of whom, if you take them together, constitute 1/16 of 1% of the population, but who take in a lion's share of income. Now, if they can raise it, the limit to $1 million without any difficulty, they could raise it even further, computers being what they are, right? So the official also noted that the rich usually understate their investment returns by about 40 to 50%. Oh, well, then we shouldn't bother the poor dears. Finally, he argued that since the very rich are so few, they're not likely to show up in a national sample. They definitely won't show up if you program them out before you even do the sampling. Ladies and gentlemen, the difference between Michael Eisner, the Disney CEO, who pocketed $565 million in 96, and the individuals in the lowest quintile who made a little over 9,000 is not 13-to-1. It's more like 60,000-to-1. And speaking of CEOs, much attention is given to the millions that are raked in by the top corporate managers, but little is said about the tens of billions that these same corporations distribute to the wealthiest class, to that fraction of 1% every year. So the media publicity that focuses on the CEOs and show what big salaries they make and all that sort of thing very conveniently avoids any exposure of the super rich as a class, even as it seems to be exposing some rich pilferers. If you want to grasp the true extent of income inequality in the United States, we should stop treating the top quintile as the richest cohort. It's time we start understanding how rich the super rich really are. People who live off immense private fortunes, by the way, they get very annoyed if it's suggested that they don't work, especially since many of them equate work with whatever activity they happen to be engaged in, serving with a charity organization or a museum board of directors, getting into photography or art or ceramics, raising horses, preparing for a long sailing expedition up the coast, or an exploration in Indonesia, going on a long retreat with their favorite guru to work on their personal spiritual development, which can take a whole lifetime. Well, this is nice work if you can get it, I suppose. Now, some wealthy individuals actually do work in the more traditional sense. They pursue professions or manage vast financial empires, but it's out of personal choice. It's not a matter of economic necessity. And the workday they put in, no matter how arduous it is, doesn't explain the source of their immense wealth, nor the pace at which it accumulates. The far greater portion of their money still comes from the ownership of assets that directly or indirectly engage the labor of others. Now, it's true, by the way, that class categories do blur at the margins. I mean, you can find employees who make so much that they eventually can just retire on investments. You can find the owning class covers such a range, giant multi-billion corporations and little mom-and-pop grocery stores, both would be designated as owning class. But the small and medium-sized businesses really don't qualify as part of the corporate owning class. I mean, there are just so many squirrels dancing among the elephants. And every week, about 600 of these squirrels are stomped out. 600 small or medium-sized businesses every week go under in America. Of course, a lot more start up, but there it is. The capitalist ideology denies that the relationship between employer and employee is exploitative. And by the way, just as they deny it with individuals, they deny it with nations also. The ideology denies that rich multinational corporations exploit poor nations. Instead, it's said that wealthy nations and corporations help develop poor nations by investing in them. As if the corporations were in the business of uplifting the poor rather than making profits off them and off their lands and their markets. Now, whether an investment helps or hinders the recipient nation depends on the terms of the investment. What portion of the earnings go to the poor nation? Does it get nothing, as happens to much of the third world? Or does it get 50% of the investment, as happens with these corporations that have developed the Cuban tourist trade, for instance? 50% of that must go to the Cuban government. How are these earnings used? Are they pocketed by a rich comprador class, or are they used for human services, again, as in Cuba? What effect on the native environment and population do these investments have? Are the people driven from the land? Is the land denuded and impoverished? What effect on native, on indigenous economic development? Is it protected and strengthened, or is it starved out and forced into underdevelopment? Generally, corporate investors have terrible negative consequences. Corporate investments have terrible negative consequences on the economies and ecologies of recipient nations. So we've explained the mystery now. Why, as corporate investments have grown greatly throughout the third world, so has poverty. Today, you see that the number of poor continues to grow at a faster rate than the world's population. They call this globalization. I call it imperialism. Again, wealth and poverty are usually seen as demographic traits that are in a kind of unfortunate proximity. Oh, so much wealth with so much poverty. Can't we do something about that? What's overlooked is to treat it in the class power context. Wealth and poverty can be seen as locked in a causal relationship. Poverty helps to create wealth. Wealth creates poverty. There can be no wealthy slaveholders unless there are impoverished, poverty-stricken slaves who consume but a fraction of the value they produce. Shortly after the American Revolution, James Madison told a visitor that he made $257 a year on every slave he owned. How so? Well, for one thing, he worked them from dawn right down into nighttime, into the middle of the night, as most slave owners did. But for another thing, he spent only $12 a year on the slave's keep. So the slave is consuming $12 but producing $257 in surplus value. And so with lords and serfs and corporate investors and their employers. So there's no vast accumulation of wealth without driving and depriving the many. What might be called the ruling class is the politically active component of this super-rich owning class. Ruling class members or their faithful acolytes occupy the top national security positions, the cabinet posts, regardless of what party or personality controls the White House. You see very few iconoclasts taking over these top policy positions or cabinet positions. Very few critics, very few public interest group advocates or labor leaders occupying these positions. Very few radicals, none that I can recall. This ruling owning class has corporations that harvest multi-billion dollar handouts from the public treasury in the form of venture capital, export capital, marketing subsidies, grants in kind, market protections, investment-free loans, bailouts, tax write-offs, equity grants, loss compensations. Again, we are being exploited as taxpayers. They enjoy the development of whole new industries at public expense, which are then handed over to private industry for development, for marketing. Railroads, aeronautics, nuclear power, pharmaceuticals, satellite communications, the internet. They plunder the public domain and put the planet's entire ecology at risk in an uncompromising pursuit of profit. They ignore viable, alternative, inexpensive, environmentally friendly forms of energy development, and not because they're stupid and lack foresight, but because they make immense profits from fossil fuels. It's not in their interest to move toward renewable, clean energy sources. They would not make the same kind of profits. As someone once said, if Exxon could own the sun and charge us for it, we would have had solar energy years ago. The plutocracy, as you know, also now creates these international trade councils, which now operate as private oligarchies with GATT, NAFTA, and now with GATS coming soon, General Agreement on Trade and Services, which will affect cities and states, to circumvent democratic sovereignty and undermine the ability of popular government to develop public sector services for anyone other than these powerful interests. And yet all of this, everything I just said, fails to enlist the attention of most mainstream social scientists and media commentaries. You're not likely to get tenure in a lot of places in this country if you push such themes too hard. And you definitely won't get a syndicated column in hundreds of mainstream newspapers or a regular pundit slot on TV political talk shows. The economic elites who compose the ruling class are neither omnipotent nor infallible. They suffer confusions and setbacks. They have differences among themselves, usually over tactical questions. They sometimes grope about, but they're not stupid. And they're well aware of their global interests, even if some of our intellectuals and publicists dare not to be. They consciously pursue their interests. And it's at that point someone says, oh, what do you have, a conspiracy theory? We recognize that all sorts of groups, farmers, teachers, anybody else, can consciously pursue their interests. But the minute you say that the people who own most of the world will consciously be concerned and pursue their interests. No class has automatic hegemony. No class can operate. There are powerful structural forces that keep it there, but no class could maintain itself unless it was consciously recreating the conditions of that hegemony. What do you mean there are a group of men sitting around in a room, I'm told? I mean, somehow, for some reason, that image is supposed to be the most devastating. Oh, sitting around in a room, I say, oh, no. No, there isn't a group of men sitting around in a room. They meet on carousels, you know, and they talk to each other like that. Or they go skydiving and they link their arms and they're talking about, so we want to raise the interest rate a little more, keep unemployment up, what do you want to do? What do you think those guys do up there when they're in a circle like that? Of course they meet in rooms. Where the hell else do you think they're going to meet in rooms? There's a lot of rooms. There's a lot of rooms in the White House. There's a lot of rooms at Bohemian Grove. There's a lot of rooms at the Bohemian Club in San Francisco. There's a lot of rooms at the Knickerbocker Club in New York. There's a lot of rooms at the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberg Conference. There's a lot of rooms at the Council on Foreign Relations. There was a lot of rooms in Uruguay when they came up with GATT and slapped us with that. There was a lot of rooms in Seattle where they were trying to meet. They meet, yeah. Nobody confabulates the way the ruling classes do. And when powerful interests do collude in this way, they make each other more powerful. You want to call that conspiracy? Call it conspiracy. I call it class politics. We often hear that if you adhere to this outworn concept of class power and class struggle, you're considered by some to be a dinosaur. That's the term, dinosaurs. Or a rigid hardliner. Or a Stalinist. Someone who edited a leftist journal, I won't again, no names, but I was on a radio show with him, and he was saying, my politics were extinct. This was right after all the Eastern European countries were overthrown, the Eastern European communist socialist governments were overthrown. My politics were extinct, he said, and one shouldn't succumb to the politics of nostalgia. I should point out, by the way, that his journal is now extinct. And for some reason, I don't feel too nostalgic about it. I was called outdated by a right-wing social democrat who didn't want me to give a keynote at the American Political Science Conference in Boston a few years ago, in what purports to be the Progressive Caucus within the APSA. And he was a member, he's a member of the caucus, but he didn't want me. He said, my ideas are outdated vehemently. More tolerant heads prevailed, and I did speak. But I thought that was a very interesting, a very revealing choice of terms. Outdated. You know, academia pretends that it's striving for eternal verities, but in fact, academia is the closest thing to the fashion industry. There's a new line coming out every few years, you know? Functionalist, then we're structuralist, then we're postmodernist, then we're post-structuralist, then anti-foundationalist, and they just go on. The new terminologies cloaking their own limited and stale ideas, ideas that are designed to occupy us and distract us with anything and everything but the realities of class power. And they, or sometimes these ideas do deal with class and class power, but without having to say those actual words. The intent is to mask them, to treat them in cloaked ways, just as Antonio Gramsci did. Not just as Antonio Gramsci did at all. They do a quite different thing with it. I'm also told to dismiss these terms and these concepts, these investigations, that there isn't going to be a workers' revolution in America. I heard that twice at a conference in Amherst a few years ago. There isn't going to be any workers' revolution in this country. Well, even if we agree with that prediction, we still might wonder how it becomes grounds for rejecting class analysis and ignoring class oppression and class power. The feminist revolution that was going to transform our entire patriarchal society has thus far not materialized, yet no progressive person takes this to mean that struggles around gender oppression are outmoded or passé. In fact, there are some conservatives who try to argue that, and even some who pretend to be feminists or neo-feminists will sort of try to smuggle in suggestions of that sort. Just because we don't have a million workers marching with red banners and singing the Internationale and putting up barricades, that doesn't mean that class struggle doesn't exist in this society. Class struggle permeates almost all employer-employee relationships, the cutbacks, the rollbacks, the fightbacks. Class power and class struggle are evident in the way the media is owned and controlled, and the kinds of news and views propagated, the way major party candidates are financed, and third parties are frozen out of the mainstream electoral process, and the way elections are stolen right from out under us. Class power, you can see it in class struggle and the way government largesse is distributed, the way deficits are piled up and have to be paid for, the way popular protests are muted and suppressed, the way dissenters are harassed and put under surveillance. There's a dimension of class struggle in how people gain access to higher education, how health care is distributed, how taxes are distributed, how the environment is treated, how the elderly poor try to survive, how women and people of color are dealt with, how religion is financed and marketed, how entertainment is organized, and a thousand other social phenomena that permeate our entire capitalist culture. How ironic that many social scientists, not all, the mainstream ones I'm talking about, many social scientists, including some, by the way, some who profess to be progressives, how ironic that they announce that class and class struggle have become largely irrelevant, outmoded, at the very time that the plutocracy is more boldly than ever trying to get us back to 1870 or 1910. While Congress at this very time is passing an enormous $50 billion tax cut, $50 billion a year in estate taxes for about 45,000 super-rich people. That's who it'll affect. $50 billion a year more they'll be able to pocket. It was the last progressive income tax we had. How ironic to say class struggle is outmoded when we face the rollback of such things as minimum wage, occupational safety, aid to poor families, public pension and disability funds, affirmative action programs, environmental protections, all of them under attack. How misleading to tell us that class isn't important at the very time when corporate class power is trying to privatize everything from public education to public water systems, and international self-appointed oligarchies are pushing free trade and undermining whatever little democratic sovereign power we've been able to muster after generations of struggle. And all the while, that portion of national income that comes from investment increases at the expense of the portion that goes for wages and salaries. Class struggle and class power are hitting us right in the face, and some people pronounce it non-existent, at the very time that the haves are trying to become the thing they really want to become, which is the have-it-alls. Ruthless and relentless, ruthless and relentless, unsparing and uncaring, grabbing, greedy, insatiable, and may they burn in hell for it. Did I actually say, may they burn in hell for it? Well, sometimes when my Marxist analysis fails me, I revert back to the... This always happens when I'm about to address Father Bill. This is uncanny. He's got a little switch back there. Father Bill, I really wish the big guy would come and play on our team for a while, you know? Can you do something about that? How ironic to claim, as some illustrious progressives have, that class is less important and culture has become more important, not understanding that culture and class are not mutually exclusive or competitive concepts, and that class war is waged throughout our culture. The ruling class understands that, and it's time that we understand it too. Well, there remain a few hopeful thoughts, socialization into the dominant culture, even though it is a monopoly capital culture, socialization into that culture does not operate with perfect effect. In the face of all monopolistic ideological manipulation, many people still perceive the disparities between social actuality and official ideology. You know, even with a drumbeat, every armed intervention that the U.S. engaged in, the polls always show, for all the one-sided propaganda, the polls show that majorities of the American people don't want commitment of U.S. troops and forces and don't think that issue really is that. It's rather extraordinary when you look at that sometimes. That's just one example. And for all the stuff, the denial, the whitewashing about environment, the overwhelming majorities of people are tremendously concerned about the environment and all. So there's other sources of consciousness besides that class-dominated culture. And as the rules push more ruthlessly, as they've got to reach for more and more, it becomes less disguised as to what they're doing. It becomes difficult for them to hide what they're doing. There's a limit to how many lies people will swallow about the reality they're experiencing. And if that were not so, if we were so thoroughly indoctrinated into the dominant culture, then I would not have been able to voice these thoughts, and you would not have been able to understand them. Years ago, the American philosopher William James observed that custom can operate as a sedative, while novelty, dissidence, deviation from the culture, is rejected as an irritant. And yet I would argue that after a while, sedatives can become suffocating and irritants can enliven. People sometimes hunger for the discomforting critical perspective that gives them a more meaningful explanation of things. They not only hunger for it, they pay $12 a head to come and be discomforted. So by becoming aware of this, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, we have a better chance of moving against the tide. We must first free ourselves from the ideological hegemony that the ruling political culture imposes on us, and on much of the left, too. It's hard to fight the enemy when the enemy has outposts in your head. This is a class struggle, not only for a fairer slice of the pie, not only for more humane and equitable services and conditions, but for the survival of the earth itself, for the fundamental direction of how society is going to be organized, for what values. Let me close by just paraphrasing a Frenchman from almost three centuries ago, 18th century philosopher, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, in his dissertation on the origin of inequality. He has a little kind of a little vignette in there, which he tries to use allegorically. He says, all of our troubles and conflicts began when that first man got the idea of digging a moat and putting up stakes and saying, this land belongs to me. And you can come in and maybe work it a little bit. I'll give you a little bit and you get out, and then I'll have more and more, and then that land will belong to me, and I'll put stakes there and there, and I'll have all of this. And Rousseau says, how many wars, how many lies, how many deceptions, how many murders, how much evil could have been avoided if the people had pulled up those stakes, had filled in that moat, and if they had said, away with you, for the fruits of the earth belong to everyone. And the earth, the beautiful earth itself, belongs to no one. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.